Morning, my name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. And again, it's a pleasure to be here. I really, really enjoyed listening to Carrie. I've never met Carrie before, and there's two levels of why I really, really like her. The first part is because she's, as an AA friend and AA sister, she's somebody that screams that she has a solution, right? And I just love that when I meet people like that. But the second level of why I like her so much is when she starts to describe being the mental institutions, the four-point restraints, the numerous therapists throwing medications on her. I'm like a cartoon character where the little chipmunk sees the beautiful girl and the eyes start popping out like little hearts, right? Because that's just been my downfall my whole life. A resume of most of my girlfriends are four-point restraints and... lots of therapists very interested in what they're doing every day. I can give you an example. Before I get into what I'm going to talk about, this will give you the example. I was 7 years sober, and I was just absolutely obsessed with this redhead that had the same type of background as she was describing. And I was 7 years sober. She was about 2 years sober, and actually... that relationship I'm about to describe actually dominates my life now. She didn't give me an STD, but it's still the dominating factor. I may get into that later, but my whole career is a result of my relationship with her. But this is an example of how crazy I can be, even at 7 years sober, even working, I was sponsoring 15, 20 people at the time. Having found this solution, I can still be quite goofy. She and I were bouncing back and forth all the time. I mean, on again, off again, fighting, oh, in love, fighting. And doing this right in front of our home group. And this one time we were broken up temporarily for maybe like 36 hours or something. And it was the Monday night four-speaker meeting there in Covina. A couple of hundred people. I probably had about 10 or 12 guys that I was sponsoring at the meeting. And we're broken up. And she walks into the meeting in these like Daisy Duke little short pants, these knee-high fur boots, and this tiny little top, and her hair all done up. And I decide to say something like, how much are you charging tonight? This went over very well with her. And she got that look in her eye, kind of like, right? And I knew it was time for me to leave because there was going to be a scene. So at the break, I'm going to sneak off and pull away from the meeting because it was obvious it was going to be another one of those scenes, and everybody's outside of the break smoking, and they're out on the sidewalk. I'm parked right there in front. Guys I sponsor all standing there, and I decide to sneak off. She sees me leaving, and she's furious. And she climbs up on the hood of my car right in front of everybody and starts pounding on the front window, swearing at me. And I decide to jerk it in reverse, and boom, she lands right on the sidewalk. And all the people there, I'm literally 100-some people are standing outside, they're going, oh. Now, this all sounds very, very sick, but I haven't told you the sick part. The very sick part was that as she was on the hood of my car, pounding on the windshield, swearing at me, and I'm behind the wheel thinking, I have never been more in love in my whole life. So this is who is here talking to you today. But I'm going to discuss the portion of the big book, the portion of chapter 5 that we read at all the meetings. You guys read it last night at the meeting I was at Wednesday, and when I was here in 2001 and 2003, and we went to various meetings. You guys all read that portion of chapter 5, that 2.5 pages. And there's a reason why. It's become very, very common all over the world that they read this portion of chapter 5 at meetings. And it's my opinion, based upon what I've experienced, is that the reason behind why it's become such a custom to read at meetings is that portion. That's for the brand new person. There's a number of reasons, but the main reason, just in case nobody says anything of value at that meeting, at least that new person is going to hear this. Right? Because we don't have faith that all over the world in Alcoholics Anonymous at every single meeting, people are talking about what we want new people to hear. So at least they'll walk away with that. But you know what? It becomes almost like the Lord's Prayer often, that we hear it so much that we don't always listen, right? It becomes sort of just background noise to our thinking during the beginning of the meeting. Do you guys do that? How many times have you, been sitting there at the meeting, it's starting, and we hear, rarely have we seen a person fail or has thoroughly followed our path, and we just start drifting off. Da-da-da-da-da. And then all of a sudden, God could and would have stopped. Oh, meeting starting. But if you're anything like me, that happens a lot. But sometimes it's because I'm emotionally disturbed, or sometimes I'm in a fantastic place, or sometimes it has to do with who's reading it. And there's something about the timbre of their voice or the level of sincerity in the way they're reading that I literally have a spiritual experience listening to chapter 5 like I have never heard it before. This is the most spiritual person in the room. Are you guys aware of that? I love children these days. I told you about that last night. More than anybody else in the whole room, her soul has not been clouded over by all of the things that block us from the Creator. So she is literally the most spiritually innocent, which is actually our goal. That's what we're trying to get to. Are you guys aware of that? Try talking to a child of her age about God. They give you this look back as, I know. I was just there. Much more recently than you. It's true. It's absolutely true. So if you're anything like me, some of the things when you start hearing, rarely we have seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, your mind may wander off like this, like mine, or maybe you have your own version of the way your mind wanders off and you miss chapter 5. My home group is a 6:15 attitude adjustment meeting in Covina, California. That's 6:15 a.m. That's very early for you Icelanders, isn't it? Yeah. You guys are going to bed sober or drunk at 4 or 5, right? My home group has between 70 to 120 people, depending on what day it is. They're at 6:15 a.m. And for a large part of the year, it is dark out when the meeting starts, and it's light out after, when the meeting gets out. And we actually have some people in my home group that think they have something to do with that. They do. I'm not one of them. No. Depends on what day, yeah. But another reason I love that as my home group is we say the third step prayer at the beginning of the meeting. We say the seventh step prayer at the end of the meeting. And this is just it's a level of step 11 for me that I recommit myself to God and ask him to remove what needs to be removed for that day so that I can be of service. And whether I'm really concentrating or not, I find it very valuable in my life that I am at least 2 to 7 times, depending on, whether I'm in town that much or whether I have my children for which days, as to I am saying that many times through every week. But if I'm having a particularly bad day, right, and I didn't listen or sincerely say the third step prayer when we open up the meeting, and my mind is in a negative place, which is quite often, and they start reading chapter 5, this is the way my mind starts to wander around if I'm having a bad day. What am I doing in Covina, California? I really should be living in West Los Angeles. That's where the real AA is, Covina. Oh, God. I love my sponsor, Ray, but why is he sitting over there with that insincere brand new guy, Rick? Rick is just relapsing again and again and again, and why? Why does Ray waste his time? Oh, God. Here's Rob, one of my good friends, but man, he's always late. And look, he's got a cup of Starbucks. If he wouldn't have stopped at Starbucks, he would have been on time. Oh, man, look at Sue over there. Man, Sue just always gossiping. She's friends with my ex-wife. I know that she told my ex-wife a whole lot of stories as to, you know, things that she heard me say in meetings through the divorce and made things really complicated. Right? And then all of it, I'm thinking of all this, and all of a sudden, God couldn't would have sought. Right? Now, here's the truth about all of that stuff that I just had these negative things to say in my own mind. When I'm in a good place, I start looking around that room, and they rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed their path. And I look around and I go, God, I am so grateful to be a member of Covina Alcoholics Anonymous. We have so many beautiful old-timers that literally are committed to Alcoholics Anonymous and working with new people. And we have an army of new people. It's like we have gold delivered to us on a silver platter. We have so many new people that are looking for this solution, and it's just such a wonderful, powerful, powerful home group. And oh, look at, that's why Ray is my sponsor. He's over there with Rick again. That's why he's my sponsor. Because he doesn't judge people as to whether they've been relapsing. He understands the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous is that you're there no matter what. Because he's going to be at the meeting no matter what. So why not sit next to Rick and maybe lend Rick a little bit of comfort and security? Why not? And Rob's walking in, and I know for a fact that because of the economic downturn, him and his wife are having to both work now, and they have three children, and they have to juggle back and forth in order to get the kids ready for school, get them over to the grandparents' house, and then Rob one day can come to the meeting, and his wife can come the other day, and every once in a while he gets a chance to stop at Starbucks and have a cup of coffee, right? That's the truth. Very committed members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the truth about Susie is she has been invaluable during my divorce, because she was friends with my ex-wife, who's not in Alcoholics Anonymous. And because of her friendship, my ex-wife has been willing to show up at numerous functions with my children, feel safe, like she has a friend, and so that my children can be with me in my recovery community. There's the truth. But my mind can twist it very, very easily. And I can be thinking all of these positive thoughts, and still, God could and would have sought, and oh, missed it again. But it must be very, very important what they read, because it's become a regular custom all over the world to read this portion of chapter 5. So let's look at what it's actually telling us. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I believe they're saying, oh yeah, we've seen some people succeed that haven't thoroughly followed our path, but you know, sometimes 50-50, maybe 30%, some. We've seen some people that actually have stayed sober, not following our path at all. Some. But hardly ever. In fact, the original manuscript said never. And for whatever reason, they decided to be a little bit politically correct and say rarely. But we've never seen somebody who has thoroughly followed our path fail. Right? And what is this path? I like to describe it in this fashion, what our path is. We often throw out, what's our path? Oh, it's the steps. Oh, it's being committed to Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, it's working with others. Yes, all of the above, but I like to describe it like this. In our history, Carrie was mentioning it too. Roland Hazard was sent over to be under the care of Dr. Carl Jung, right? And they did some marvelous, marvelous therapy. Roland's parents and his family were just fed up with his drinking, sent him over. It's probably the most expensive treatment that you could possibly have at the time. I mean, you know, there's only two schools of thought if you're going to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist. You're either Jungian or you're Freudian. It's a good thing they somehow wound up sending Roland to Carl Jung. Just think what AA would look like if they had sent him to Freud. Right? So again, God's hand. But after a whole year of therapy, Roland leaves. Believes he, you know, and Jung says, I think you really have done some phenomenal work here. And he's drunk before he even gets on the ship back to the U.S. Comes back to Jung, and Jung goes, ooh, oops, I misdiagnosed you. Apparently you are a chronic alcoholic, and I have never seen personally even one case recover. I've heard after Roland just sunk in his heart and goes, is there really no hope? Because one of the two greatest psychologists, psychiatrists in the world was saying, I have personally never seen one single case recover where this alcoholic mind, this chronic alcoholism, exists in the extent that it does in you. I've never seen it. And Roland was, is there really no hope? And he said, well, I've heard, Jung says, that every once in a while throughout history, here and there, there have been these vital rearrangements of attitudes, this vital spiritual awakening that is necessary to recover from this chronic alcoholism. But I've never been able to recreate that in anyone. I've never actually seen it, but I've heard it. And so what he's describing is that throughout the history of mankind, apparently, ever since mankind accidentally stepped on a grape, left it there for a while, and licked it up off the dirt and went, whoo, right, and invented alcohol, there have been alcoholics. And every once in a while, here and there, people have popped up like, oh my God, I don't need to drink anymore. And it might be in a congregation or just who knows where, just boom, pops up like a stray kernel of popcorn. And everybody in the community would turn to this person and say, how did you do it? My father is dying. Come help him to find what you found. My brother, my sister, my husband, my wife, come help them. Give them what you found. And this person has always said, I would if I could, but I don't know how this happened. I don't know how this happened. What Alcoholics Anonymous has become is that we have become a way to mass produce these spiritual awakenings that has never before existed on the planet. We found out how we can create that spiritual awakening that Jung could not do, right? Jung knew what our solution was supposed to be, but he didn't know how to create it. And if you look at the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I may touch on that at some other point as we're talking this weekend, but, you know, the problem was as a result of Silkworth, defined by Silkworth. Jung knew our solution, because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. We've got to know the problem, got to know the solution, we've got to have a plan of action to bring it about. And the three things that happened there at the very same time in history is Silkworth defined the problem. Jung knew the solution. Oxford Movement had a plan of action, right? So through this amazing thing that happened, we've learned how to mass produce this spiritual awakening necessary to recover from alcoholism. It's the same idea as prior to Henry Ford inventing the idea of mass production and the conveyor belt in order to for the common man to have the automobile. See, prior to Henry Ford and the Model T Ford, only the few, only the super elite, I mean, not just rich, you had to be very rich in order to have an automobile. Until Henry Ford came up with the method of mass production so that the common man, pretty much anybody of lower middle class or higher, could have an automobile. And this conveyor belt is just like our path, right? How did they do mass production? They'd put the chassis on, they'd add the wheels, they'd put the body on, they'd put the engine in. As it goes down the conveyor belt, at the end, you are guaranteed to have a Model T Ford. That's what our path is. You come into Alcoholics Anonymous. You get a sponsor. You get commitments. You start working steps. You go through the book. You learn to work with others. And as you are doing all of this down the conveyor belt, at the end, you are guaranteed to have a spiritual awakening of the type that is able to solve our problem of alcoholism. The problem is many of us, as we're going down the conveyor belt, get better ideas. And we hop off the conveyor belt and start pointing at the people on the conveyor belt, shouting obscenities at them. Oh, it's a cult, right? It's a cult, Alcoholics Anonymous. Have you guys heard that? Alcoholics Anonymous is a cult? It's ridiculous. We can disprove that right now. A cult, by definition, is they tell the person, you must sell all of your worldly goods, get rid of all of your worldly goods, give them away or give them to us, some or whatever, but get rid of your worldly goods, and we want you to excommunicate and not speak to all of your loved ones and come in and follow us. That's a cult. Alcoholics Anonymous says, oh, we know you don't got shit. You don't got a goddamn thing. And nobody's talking to you. Come in here and we'll teach you how to get some stuff back if you want it. And we'll teach you how to get those people back in your life that you love and care about and teach you how to talk to them. It's exactly the opposite. It's the most ridiculous thing to call Alcoholics Anonymous a cult. All right, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves a simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Ardenar told me that even your newest translation, I know that your prior translation before 2003 had a lot of loopholes in it, that you missed a lot of key things, and apparently there's a couple of mistakes even in the newer translation, and that your translation says those who do not recover are people who cannot and will not. Okay, this is not my opinion. You need to cross that out. You need to cross out the word and replace it with or. That's just not my opinion. It's right here in black and white, and it's a very important aspect because I know we all like to be politically correct and say nobody knows who makes it in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's just fine if you want to be politically correct in your group and you don't want to sound like you got a lot of ego and you know who stays sober and who doesn't. But the book tells us at every single meeting who stays sober and who doesn't. Right? Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves this simple program. So if you've been relapsing and in and out and in and out and in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, you got to ask yourself, am I a cannot or am I a will not? And I will tell you that in my experience, 99.9% are will nots. They describe some of the cannots, but if we're honest with ourselves, we will say, I'm a will not. If you're honest with yourself, you'd probably find, I continually jump off the conveyor belt. I am constantly doing half measures. I am regularly not showing up for my commitments. I am regularly putting other things in front of Alcoholics Anonymous because I am not completely. Because we like to take the stance, oh, yeah, I'm alcoholic, but I got this other life. Yes, part of me is alcoholic, but I'm not really all alcoholic. So do I really have to be all in Alcoholics Anonymous? I got to tell you, I don't know, any of you guys watch poker on TV? Do you watch a little bit? You guys will understand this. At some level, at some stage of a poker tournament, you are at some point, you have to go all in. And once you say those words, I'm all in, there's no changing your mind. When somebody else calls you and you see what cards they have compared to what's on the board, you can't say, oops, can I take some of that back? No. It is completely, you make the decision, you are all in. There's no turning back. And that is what Alcoholics Anonymous means when they say completely give yourself to this simple program. If you are somebody who honestly says you're a cannot, then you are apparently in this category, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Now, they're not talking about constitutionally incapable of being honest, you know, at the cash register when somebody, you know, a cashier accidentally gives you an extra $5 or what would that be? That'd be 500 kroner extra change, you know, or maybe you're lying because you've got two boyfriends or two girlfriends and you're lying a little bit in order to, you have to, are you aware of that? If you got two or three boyfriends or girlfriends, you have to do a little bit of lying. I don't have any experience with that. But you have, right? But you can actually stay sober and find this solution even while you're battling with this type of level of honesty. I have to say that because I've done it, and thousands of others that I have met over the years and listened to their stories, they have had various struggles with levels of honesty all throughout their sobriety, new and not so new. What they're talking about, being honest with ourselves, is all about step one and what Carrie was so beautifully describing. I have to be completely honest with myself about my alcoholism. If I can stay in the truth about I cannot drink successfully, I cannot not drink successfully. My spirit is dead. I don't know how to see the colors of life or interact with other people. If I can stay completely honest with myself about that every single day, I can find this. I'm not in that category. But apparently there are some people who absolutely, constitutionally, meaning at their core, are unable. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. At least that's what they'll tell you. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. This was what I found so beautiful about Carrie, because she talked about all of the, where society was claiming that she has grave emotional and mental disorders, and they were acting like that, right? Because, and all I'm doing is I'm just stating the obvious of the way she described it. When society is putting you in four-point restraints, salting your tail with numerous medications, and having 3 to 4 professionals analyze you, you're in a bit of trouble, right? This is not when society goes, oh my God, what a successful life. But she, and that's what's so beautiful about her, was able to describe her way out of that, and is able to verbalize in a very powerful way her way out. And that's exactly what they're talking about. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Right? Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. You ever wondered, boy, if I get called on in a meeting, or if I get asked to speak, or you know, do 10 minutes, what do I say? Now, in Southern California, you guys ever wondered why so many people that speak in meetings come from Southern California? You ever wondered why is that? Is that just because we're like hams or all the nutcases wind up in California? It's simply because of the structure of AA in Southern California. In Southern California, and what I say about Southern California is I'm talking about all the way from San Diego up to Santa Barbara, from Santa Monica out to Palm Desert, Palm Springs. Giant, giant area. In that area, however, it's not so giant. We regularly drive back and forth to meetings within that area. There are over 6,000 meetings per week in that area. Of those 6,000 meetings, 800 of them are speaker meetings. That's why there's so many people that speak that come from Southern California, because they're constantly trying to fill podiums. 800 secretaries a week are calling all over the place trying to find somebody new to put up at the podium. So if you accidentally say something clever while you're sharing at a meeting, all of a sudden people are calling you, oh, come on out to Burbank. It's like, what? We heard you said a great one-liner. Come on out. It's because they're trying to fill the podiums, right? That's why. So if you got a couple of years, and you are thrown up there. So people are always wondering, what do I say? What do I say? What do I say? And it's like, I want to say to them, how many meetings have you been to? Oh, a couple thousand by now. I'm 3 years sober. Well, they've been reading it at every single meeting that you've been going to. What you're supposed to share in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you are sharing for 3 minutes at a participation meeting or a full hour-long tell your whole story. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And if it's 3 minutes, figure out in 1 minute how you can convince people you are alcoholic, what we call qualify or get people to identify, to describe your drinking and how you feel when you're not drinking. Spend 1 minute on what happened and 1 minute on what you're trying to do today. That's exactly it. That's how we're supposed to share in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a guideline because that's what we want any new person to hear in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when you are sitting there frustrated at the meeting because your old-timer is telling the same story that he told last week, I have got news for you. He's not talking to you. He's talking to the person that you are apparently unaware that is even in the meeting. The brand new person that we don't know. And many, depending on the size of the meeting, you may or may not know. In many meetings in Southern California, there's 200, 400, 900 meetings. 900 people in a meeting. 200, 400, 900 at the Pacific Group. And many, many are 400, many are 200. There's all sorts of people that just come in and drift out. Come in and drift out. And unless there's a gang of men and women who are searching the backs of the rooms, interacting with everybody, and there's many that do. Many, many, many that do. People can drift in and drift out. So the old timers know this. They've known this for decades in Southern California, and I'm sure all over the world. So they will be telling the same story, throwing out the same line for that person, not for your benefit. So maybe you ought to learn to be able to do the same thing. Put together a few things that you can say that is for the benefit of the person sitting back there that nobody is even aware is there. Not to impress your friends. I don't come and do this to impress people. If I was here to entertain you or travel around to do this, if it really was to entertain people with time, I would say, you know what? You need to pay me. You need to pay me if you want me to come and entertain you and talk to people with a lot of time. But I'm here to talk to the person that brand new. That's why it's worth it. That's why it's worth it to give up the time. Carrie has 4 children. She doesn't have time to do this yet. I'm just a co-parent of 2, and I don't got the time to do this shit. But I have a love for Alcoholics Anonymous that overrides that. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. When you're working with people, you ever hear this? Or just people asking questions. It's always in the question and answer. When should I work the steps? And I always gently and playfully ask, how many meetings have you been to? Oh, I've been to about 50. Well, then you've heard it 50 times when you are supposed to work the steps. And they go, really? And we go right here. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. That's when you're supposed to work the steps. And that doesn't matter whether it's 30 minutes after getting here or 3 years. I strongly advise you not to sit for 3 years, but it's possible. My guess is you will not be sitting here sober for 3 years. You will be coming and going and coming and going. And at some point, if you live, because this is a deadly disease, it's not a little thing to play with. It's a deadly disease. If you live, at some point you will reach that place of that you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. I want you to notice that it says if you want what we have, it does not say if your wife wants what we have or wants you to have what we have. It does not say if your employer has decided you want what we have. It does not say if your probation officer has decided you want what we have. And also notice, it does not say if your sponsor has decided you want what we have. Now, a good sponsor will be all over you and trying to work steps with you, but probably will not take with you until you want what we have and are willing to go any length to get it. That is when you are ready to accept these very simple but drastic steps in your life. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. I remember when I described that sometimes as I'm listening to chapter 5, I have I really, really listen. And one of these times I was really, really listening, and this sentence hit me. And I was probably 15 years sober when I heard it. And it just hit me as to what that sentence was really saying. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. And what I felt as I sat there in that day when somebody was reading chapter 5 is I heard our founders talking to us from the grave. With all the earnestness at our command. And they wrote that so they could talk to us from the grave, because of anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous in the 75 years that we've been here, there's probably nobody that knows more, that had seen more of the desperation and the people dying by the waysides again and again, because they did not have a giant fellowship to lean on, to scoop people up into, and to be able to have numerous people working with them. Everything was riding on their shoulders. And they probably saw every single type of person come and go and die. And so from the grave, they're saying, with all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Even our good ideas? Yeah, even your good ideas. Here's an example. My father, I told you my father was a Swedish Lutheran minister. That often conjures up people's immediate thing is, oh my God, he might have been in a very strict religious home. Not true. Because if it was, then that would certainly be an old idea that should easily be cast aside in order that I can have a new experience. Because apparently I have to have a new experience, because the old experiences were not working. But that's not who my father was at all. My father, when we were 4 years old, I was born in Helena, Montana. At 4 years old, my father took the whole family, my brother, my sister, and me, and my mother, to the island of Borneo. It's a Muslim state. It's part of the Federation of Malaysia as of 1960. He had a contract with the Basel Christian Church out of Switzerland. He was there to go start a church, a Christian church, on the island of Borneo. He did profound work there. But the rest of his life, he never talked about the work that he did there. He talked about that time of his life. He must have been in his early 40s about that time, as a profound spiritual awakening for him. Because when you go into seminary and you're from a Swedish family and a line of pastors, and you go into seminary and you just have this very single mind. I mean, Scandinavian Lutherans are so isolationist. I mean, if you're not a Scandinavian Lutheran, you're not going to heaven. It's not just that you need to believe in Christ, you need to be a Scandinavian Lutheran. I mean, that's single-minded, for God's sake. That's even saying the Pope is in question. So let alone the other world religions. And my father was always a very intelligent, bright man who loved life, and he had been questioning a lot of that quietly. And when he went to Borneo, and we were exposed on all sides by Islam, Hindu, Buddhism, and he found the beauty in all of that. He talks about that as the most biggest revelation he had as a minister, when he saw other beautiful, God-loving people who had different customs, right? And it completely changed everything he did in his life from that day forward, right? And his attitudes and how he talked with people, and you can just imagine when he came back to the Swedish Lutheran Church and started instituting Eastern philosophies into the congregation. Congregation changed very quickly. Right? So I was raised with an extremely open mind spiritually. An all-encompassing God. Numerous different ideas and pathways. I actually am someone who, when I hear, these days, you often, I don't know if you guys, you're CNN around here, I don't know how much television, but I don't know how much exposure you get to, as we do in the U.S., about the terrorism. You know, all I've seen right now is Japan going on right now. But in the U.S., numerous news stations, they always use that Muslim call to prayer, right, that they blast out over their cities, as a way to instill fear, anxiety, and frustration in the American people. And then they start talking about news and terrorism. But to me, hearing that Muslim call to prayer is an overwhelming, comforting. I get this feeling of my childhood, and it was overwhelmingly comfortable. When I go into a Buddhist temple and I smell the incense, I get awash with memories. Right? I don't get the reason I'm bringing this up is that although I had a very healthy perception of God when I got sober, I needed to let go of those ideas also. I needed to let, because apparently those experiences and those memories and those thoughts about what God is and is not were not sufficient. I needed to even let go of what even today describing would be a very healthy perception of God. All my parents had ever instilled in me when they would be desperately trying to get me to be happy, because they saw what, you know, other than the horrific things I was doing while drinking, they saw that I was extremely unhappy when not drinking. And of course, they would try to help me. They would send me to psychologists. They would send me to what you would call these days a life coach, you know, somebody to try to instill something in me. All they tried to instill in me is, Carl, God gives everybody gifts. The pathway to happiness and usefulness is find out what those gifts are, cultivate them, and use them to help other people, and you will find a happy and useful life. Now, what they're talking about is a basic spiritual principle that I never was able to apply. And Aldous Huxley, the philosopher that used to hang with Timothy Leary, right? So there's some question about some of the things he said. But one of the most beautiful things that he said about God is, God is the inner experience of principles applied. That is absolutely true. My problem my whole life is I had never applied a single principle. My problem with it is that I had always viewed the world in two ways. The good people and the people I can hang with. And I can only hang with the good people for about 18 hours. And I got to run back down into the pigsty. I can't be good. And I always thought that you had to be good in order to apply spiritual principles. That you can't, I didn't understand that those people were applying spiritual principles, so therefore they had a life that to me looked like you were good people. And that was one of my problems first coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. You look strangely like the good people. As I got to know you, I found out that wasn't true. That you were as sick as they come, but you were applying principles by which you were able to make your life look like what I had always defined the good people as. And that just means successful, useful people in the community, having lives that are basically peaceful and lack of conflict. Right? That's all it really was. But I had defined it as something that was unattainable. So I had to let go of even my good ideas. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. My second sponsor, Eddie Cochran's widow, often makes this joke, and it's always really quite funny. She always says, whenever she's working with her new girls, and we get to that point of, remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. I always ask my new girls, which word in that sentence is the most important? And they all chime in, oh, it's powerful. Oh, no, it's cunning. No, it's baffling. And she always chuckles the way she would. No, it's remember. And that's really very true. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Maybe you're like me. And this has been read 1,000 times in front of me before I realized this. But one of the things that I thought I was hearing in Alcoholics Anonymous was that there were multiple gods. And Alcoholics Anonymous believed in multiple gods, like pagan Rome. And I used to tease with a couple of guys, well, pagan Rome fell. So, right? That's not what Alcoholics Anonymous says. And because you always hear about, you know, I teased last night about the relationship God, that God's not a pimp, right? And then people talk about, and God gave me a parking spot, and God has found me a job, and all of these, and my God. Oh, you can borrow my God. And it sounds like people are talking about that there are multiple gods, and that's the doctrine of AA. No. There's one who has all power. That one is God. And the beauty of AA is you get to perceive that in any way you want. Oh, you're Christian. Fantastic. Oh, you're Muslim. Great. Jewish? Great. Fantastic. Love it, love it, love it, love it. Buddhist? Taoist. Wonderful. Nothing? Great. Love you. Oh, you're just sort of like making a very simple idea of God of just simply, you don't know, but you know. Okay, fantastic. Alcoholics Anonymous says, fantastic. See, that's what actually makes us different from a religion. Because if you're new, we could look strangely like a religion, right? We're all sitting here in a church, right? Somebody has a book up here and is preaching hellfire and brimstone. If you don't do this, you're going to drink, right? Just like the preacher. You go to hell if you don't, right? When somebody gets a little bit overzealous and they're bam, bam, bam. And then the big catch, we pass the offering plate. It could strangely look like a religion. But the only reason we're not is one simple thing. We don't define God. We don't define God in any way, shape, or form. Whatever your perception is fantastic. The only thing that I believe our guidelines say, and you can absolutely believe differently, is that it must be a power greater than yourself. I don't subscribe to the doorknob idea because that's a man-made object, and if my God is a doorknob, I could go up and destroy it and say, well, now what are you going to do, buddy? I'll take that doorknob and crush it out in the snow, right? So it must be a power greater than yourself, however you want to describe it. And I remember when I was bouncing around, and thinking that you were talking about multiple gods, and I remember one day I was extra frustrated, and I called my father. And I just described to you who my father was. And I thought I'd call my father. He'd tell me who God is. I'd come back and straighten out that meeting that was very confused. Right? I'm about 4 months sober. They were very interested in what I had to say. So I called my father. And I said, Dad, you've been a minister and a theologian for over 40 years. You've spent your whole life studying about, talking about, designing your life around God. Please, tell me, what's God? And my father said, how long has it been since you've had a drink? And I said, about 4.5 months. He said, well, then God is whatever got you to those people in AA. For Christ's sake, do what they say. Click. It's really true. There is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measured availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. We're right back to the completely and complete abandon. Right? It's the whole half measure thing. Doesn't work. Got to dive into this completely. Got to ask his help with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives would become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. Do not be discouraged. Because when you read the steps and you really try to grasp it, it seems like a tall order. It seems like you're asking me to be one of the good people. That's the way I felt. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. No one. Not me. Not Arna. Arna, you've been able to practice Perfect. Carrie? Not my sponsor, Ray G. He'll have 40 years this year. He's been my third sponsor. My two others are dead now. I talked about that last night. Of all men that are kinder and gentler and more committed to Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't name another person that I know well enough that could outdo my sponsor, Ray G. He's the patriarch, comforting figure of Covina Alcoholics Anonymous. Constantly, he's 85, and he still shows up, and he still takes phone calls from over 35 to 50 men at a time. Even Ray. Even Clancy. He was one time in a room, and I checked with him. I said, Clancy, you? And he goes, some days. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like. That means not even effing close. Anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. So quit judging each other. There's nothing more damaging in a home group as to when you start judging each other and there's infighting. And you're fighting and squabbling over stuff that 6 months later you won't even remember what you were fighting about. As you try to tell the story, you'll be going, what were we fighting about? And yet people are splitting off and leaving meetings. And here's an example. I want to tell you the story about me doing exactly what I'm talking about in my home group in the mid-90s. I'm sponsoring a lot of guys. I also run a group of recovery homes. All of those people in those recovery houses are very active in our home group in AA. Everybody needs to be at a minimum of 14 meetings per week. Most of the people early on were very supportive, but there were a whole other school of thought that were not. Oh my God, why are they polluting our meetings with all of these new people? And it became a big fight, but especially between me and this one other guy, very wealthy man, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a good man, didn't think so at the time. But he also employed a lot of people in AA. So he had his army, I had mine. And we started fighting. We started fighting and bickering, and he would say things about me, and I would fire back. And we were saying it at coffee shops. We would try to say it without saying it from the podium. You know how to do that? How to say something without really saying it, but if you know the situation enough, you know what you're saying? Ha! And there was a man that described this fight that went on for a couple of years as the Navajos and the Apaches. That Covina AA had split into two as the Navajos and the Apaches. And when I heard him describe that, this is years later, and I'll describe the solution and the amends that this man and I made and how we continue to make living amends to our home group for this. When he described us as the Navajos and the Apaches, I looked back and I go, whoa, look at what we were doing in our home group. If you look back at American history, there were many Indian tribes that fought amongst each other along with against the real invaders. And for us to be fighting like we were in our home group at the level that we were fighting, it got so big, such a fight that this fellow went and opened up another club down the street, called it the Other Club. Right? I mean, we split. If you look back at American history, for us to be fighting in our home group would be sort of like a scout from the cavalry standing up on a large cliff. You can see a big plateau, looking down on the plains. Giant army behind this scout. Tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers coming behind him. And he's looking down on the plains and watching the Navajos and the Apaches fighting and killing each other. And that scout would say to himself, why are they fighting each other when we're here? And that's the way that alcoholism was looking down at our home group and was saying, why are they fighting each other when I'm here? It can be so damaging to a home group. got to let go of petty differences. They got to be laughed aside. What happened between this man and I was that we finally saw what was going on. He kind of saw it first. He saw that actually what he thought I was doing was completely false. And he made a grand and overt gesture of amends. He called me up one day and said, "Carl, I don't know how to apologize, but one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to send you, I have this nonprofit foundation off on the side that I use to give medical care to brand new people if they don't have health insurance, and they can come and be sent to a clinic if they have minor medical issues that they need to address." And he said, "I'm going to make this giant donation to your foundation as a result of my behavior towards you." And then he came to this golf tournament that I hold, and there's about 150 AA men at this golf tournament, and he walked up to the podium and kissed me on the lips. It's like, that's a little bit grand, don't you think, Larry? And I made my amends to him as best I could, and how we continue to do this, to make living amends to our home group, is that every major AA event in Covina, we have a number of them. Giant Christmas Alcathon, the opening meeting is just packed with people, and we have Thanksgiving opening meeting of Alcathons, we have various things. Most of the time, he and I get called on at these things, and we both talk about this thing that I'm talking about now and how damaging it can be to the home group, so that people that did not even experience it can know that no future infighting can go on. The other amazing thing that he often talks about is, and shortly after we resolved this issue, I was in court with my son, and the judge told my son, "You will either do 3 years in prison or you're going to go to Puente House," which is my recovery centers. And this guy goes, "Oh, thank God I made amends," right? Because his son wound up coming to us. And had we still been fighting, that beautiful, his son is now like 9 years sober, right? That never would have happened. We would have been blocking God's hand in 1,000 different ways. So you got to stop the infighting. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. It's always a journey. It's never the destination. We are simply on a spiritual journey, trying to seek our Creator. And we do it first by being able to get sober. And then, as at least in my life, I have looked a lot of different ways. And I have learned wonderful things from a million different pathways to God. But my foundation is in working with others, taking my seat in my home group, being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that has to be the foundation, which allows me the luxury of taking a look at how has this people been doing it for 5,000 years. How have these people been doing it for 2,000 years? How have these people been doing it for 1,800 years? And just learning and experiencing. But my foundation, where I really experience God, I believe I have, I like to call it an alcoholic heart. And it seems like no matter where else I've looked, and it's been, you know, interesting, and I've had experiences around the world and with various different things. But the experience that is profound enough for me to be comfortable sober has always come when I'm working with another alcoholic, right? So I cannot deviate. I don't know how many friends I have had over the years that have branched off onto those things that I've just described, and they have replaced that from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always like to give them a call and say, "Oh, I'm not putting down your new spiritual path. Just remember that's a wonderful thing to do in between meetings. Not in place of." And they go, "Oh, Carl, you're still in spiritual kindergarten with that AA. It's like, "Oh, no, 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 no." I call it floating out the top of AA. There's two ways out of AA: dropping out the bottom, drinking, or floating out the top, where you become too spiritual for it to be any earthly good. And forgetting where my gift came from, because there's nothing more offensive to my perception of my Creator is that I am disregarding the greatest gift He ever gave me, sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me to then branch off elsewhere, I am not of use over there. I'm of use here. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. So what they're saying is, hopefully by this time that you've gotten here in the book, you've got three things in place. You have read our description of the alcoholic, which is the doctor's opinion. There is a solution, Bill's story. There is a solution and more about alcoholism. That's the book's description of the alcoholic. They are assuming we've read that. We've read the chapter to the agnostic and our personal adventures before and after. Now, before, like Carrie was saying, that it used to be mail order sobriety. I always describe it. She said that you're somewhere in Nebraska and you write the letter. I always like to describe, because Covina used to be all orange groves, and I used to describe, right, you're passed out in the orange grove and your wife comes and throws this thing at you and says, "Get sober, SOB!" Right? And you would kind of come to and go, "Huh?" Because she wrote to Bill. But hopefully you've got these three ideas in place if you've gotten this far in the book. And to be this far, you need to have the description of the alcoholic. You read the chapter to the agnostic and our personal adventures. And what they are talking about back in those days was you've read some of the stories in the back and hopefully identified. These days, we hope you've read some of the stories in the back and been to enough meetings where people are sharing responsibly as they tell their stories that you have identified. By this time, if you've done those things, you will have these three ideas in place. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Okay. Thank you very much, and we'll see you after lunch. Thanks.